Okay. Sorry, no political announcements to start off with. The guys might come in a minute and try and take over. Does anybody have notes? Are they outside or not? Okay, we may get somebody running in at the last minute with them. They're online anyway. You can get them later if you need them. So I'm not going to talk about, we're going to move on from, we've had structured data, which is really, really organized, unstructured data, semi-structured data, which is less organized, or is maybe unstructured data with some annotations. And we're now, the remaining lectures in the course are going to be about unstructured data. And obviously this looks a really neat alignment. You have structured, semi-structured, unstructured. That's not entirely, it's not always that simple. It's just a convenient way to group things. But it is a reasonable class of where you have some data, maybe a lot of data, and it doesn't have any immediate structure on it. Today I'm going to talk about a little bit about data retrieval, how you extract, retrieve some data from a big mass of unstructured information. Actually that takes a couple of lectures, and then the remaining lectures are on statistical analysis of this data. So techniques you can use on, mathematical techniques you can use to analyze large bodies of data you can't immediately understand by looking at, but also maybe doesn't have enough structure or annotation attached to it to do a more structured search through it. And as you can see, we'll revisit this as your collocations. And some of these things with semi-structured data where you maybe have a hypothesis, you have an idea from looking at the structure, looking through it, doing some searches, but you want to get some statistical evidence to back up your hypothesis, and maybe essentially you're doing empirical science on large bodies of data. First, there's some administration. As mentioned last week, there's a staff-student liaison meeting today at 1 o'clock. This is the teaching staff and the student reps. So if you are a student rep, please come along. And if you have something you'd like your rep to raise, to ask about, to mention, to comment on, good or bad, please mail the reps at info@lists.inf@acarc. If there are any comments you'd like them to make or pass on. And please do that. There's a lot of people from lots of different backgrounds doing Inf1, and we need as many routes as possible to communicate these kind of messages that you have. Tell your tutors about things, ask your tutors about things, come and tell me after the lectures or any of the other lecturers, send mail to the reps, or ask the reps to raise things. This way, people's concerns and things you notice, things that go well and go badly, we will find out about, because otherwise we might not know. You don't all need to turn up to the meeting yourself. It's quite a small room. But if you tell the reps, then they should carry things through. And if your reps don't respond or don't do things, then hassle them about this. It is their job. Coursework assignment. So this is in addition to the regular weekly tutorial work, and it was posted last Friday. It's 3 past exam questions to work through. So this is essentially a mock exam. You don't have to do it timed. You don't have to do it without the books or without the internet. You can take as much time as you like over it and talk to as many other people as you like about it, but it gives you an idea of what's in the exam questions. So who has downloaded the coursework? Anybody? Anybody? Oh, several people. That's good. Can you confirm that it looks like 3 exam questions? Yeah, okay, it's good to have this kind of loop that goes around, because occasionally we post stuff and it's completely meaningless, or we put up the wrong document or back to front. And then like 2 weeks later, somebody says, do you realize that actually what you've posted is back to front or missing page 5? And you think, well, that's interesting. I wonder if anybody ever looked. Do get back to us if things seem to be wrong. It's due in a week on Friday to the your written solutions to the box outside the ITO. It was previously, as it's been issued as a week's coursework. We're issuing it a little bit earlier than that this year to give you more time to do it. Not because it'll take longer, but to juggle time between other assignments. It's marked by your tutors, and they will return it to you in the tutorial in the last week of semester with marks, and also they'll give some feedback. You can ask some questions about it. You can go through it with them in that tutorial. It's not for credit, so you get marks, you know what kind of score it is, but it doesn't affect your final grade. This means that you can discuss and ask other people for help. There's no sense in which it has to be done under exam conditions or to show it's your own personal exclusive work. This is something that if you can get help from somebody else or if you can find help online, then do, please. The idea is that you learn by doing it, and this prompts you maybe if there's something you didn't understand to find out more about it or try and back it up. Okay, any questions about the coursework assignment? Anybody completed it all? No, I shouldn't ask you this. That's not fair. If you enjoyed it, there are lots more past questions online. And yeah, do them. They're kind of practice. They're not entirely predictable, but many of them have a kind of standard format examining the same sorts of material in the course. And so do them. This is a good way to get familiarize yourself with the kind of things you might need to know, and also the kind of things that we're trying to teach you in the course. Okay, unstructured data. So some examples of what might count as unstructured data. This is kind of nebulous because almost any data you can find some structure in, but what we're looking at is data where the structure is not explicit, or it's not been annotated or added on or made use of. So plain text. Now, as we discussed in the last few lectures, there's text has lots and lots of structure, particularly if you understand the language it's written in, you can see lots of structure. But it's somehow intrinsic to the data. It's not imposed by somebody else organizing it, and unless you have annotations on it, then it's not necessarily immediately visible. So we could annotate and add structure, but also we could try and treat text purely as unstructured data and see what kind of information we can get out of it. Bitmaps, graphics, pictures, sound, movies, and so on. So again, there's intrinsic structure in there, especially if they're of a sound of something of significance rather than white noise or a picture of a thing. And we could add structure to it. We could identify objects in it. We could isolate, or we could identify objects through movies, the same object appearing multiple times. In digitized sound, we can identify what instruments are playing or what people are talking. So we can impose structure again, but initially it's just purely unstructured data. That's at a slight level of abstraction. Of course, actually, the kind of data, graphic data, to some extent sound, and to a lot, movies, there's storage media. We use a lot of structure in compression and things like that. So, for example, digital films use a lot of compression techniques that rely on the structure that's in the film, that films typically contain the same things repeatedly, and things move around. So you can often describe one frame as being like the last frame, but moved over a little. And that's essential to the compression technique, but it's not necessarily immediately useful for analysis. So if you abstract over that, it's, an image is just a bitmap, and a film is just a sequence of bitmaps. Scientific results, so experimental results. Again, initially, they're just a lot of numbers. They might be kind of some structure in the representation. They're points in n-dimensional space. They're records of experimental results or something that happened. This gave this reaction, or this thing had a following concentration over time. But often, one of the things we want to do in a scientific experiment is uncover implicit structure. You have lots of time series for what the concentrations were of which chemicals in some process over time, or you identify particular genes being activated or inactivated or repressed in a cell culture over time when certain things are added or when things happen. And you have these time series, and you then want to discover structure within it. You want to find out whether your hypothesis about how some cell works or how some engineering process will be improved by a particular change to it will or will not work. And you want to find out how things, what the structure is inside it. So we have lots of examples, we have lots of ideas of unstructured data, and like all of the other data, there's more of it than there ever has been, and in principle that means you can do more things, but for however large your machine, there will always be data sets that are pushing the limits on that. So you have to think about what are effective algorithms to look over things, to extract information. Principally, once it gets beyond the things you can just look at on the page, you have to have some algorithm for doing it. Once it gets beyond an amount that a computer can readily scan all of it, you have to think of smart ways of looking for information in it. Okay, so we're going to look at two different topics in unstructured data. So again, it's a huge field. There are lots of things you can do. So these are just examples of approaches to solving particular kinds of problem. Information retrieval and some basic statistical analysis. And I'll start with information retrieval. The information retrieval problem is that you have some large collection of documents, possibly completely unstructured, just some text. And you want to extract something of interest to some particular topic. Possibly you want to identify which documents are relevant to a particular query. So here's the general setup. You've got some query, and you have some large number of documents, some of which are probably relevant to the query. And the task is to find the documents that are relevant to that query. You want to find, ideally, all of them, and you only want to find documents that are relevant to the query. So, examples given here. Searching a library catalog. A library catalog is a large document, perhaps comprising several sub-documents because you've got different kinds of catalogues for different parts of the library or different kinds of elements stored in the library, and you want to extract just the records for books that you're interested in or books that have some relevance to your query. Other things like news wires, you might have a large archive of news articles, which are essentially just text, lots and lots of pieces of text, and you want to find all of the news articles relating to some subject. As you want to do this dynamically, you're providing a clipping service for somebody who's interested in every story that mentions the University of Edinburgh, or you're doing research. You want to find every story that has been relevant to some topic that you want to find out about. So you have maybe some words that you want to search for, but you want to find every news article that covers that topic. A legal database, this is a big application of information retrieval and large computer-based systems. You might have all the legal judgments or the documents from a whole set of cases in a country or a state or particular legislature, and you want to find all previous cases or documents that have appeared in previous cases related to a particular subject area. Patent searching is another such thing. Looking in research papers, if you've got a scientific field, it may well be that there are more papers published in that area than it is possible for you to read in real time. So that they're being published faster than you can read them. So even if you devoted every hour of every day to reading papers published in your field, you would fall behind. Certainly some areas of biology and physics are getting like that. Even if you have try and focus yourself to a very narrow area of research, there's just too many people doing too much stuff. And so you might have a large database of scientific research papers, and you want to find all the papers relevant to a particular topic, and you don't want to have to look through all of the titles of all of them yourself. So these are all information retrieval tasks. And of course, web search is the dominant information retrieval task. Though there is a lot of structure and people, it's a lot of focus effort on that particular kind of search. So I won't actually talk today at all about how you might do the information retrieval task, how you might find the right documents. That's coming up later. But the first thing perhaps is to look at, well, how would you know when you'd succeeded? So one of the features of this is you have a collection of documents that is bigger than you can see, bigger than you can read through. So you write a tool, it produces some answers. Were they good? Were they the best? Could you do better? Are they better than somebody else's tool? So it's really important in this to say in advance how you would measure the performance of an information retrieval system before you start saying, my algorithm is better than your algorithm, or I can do this or I can do that. You want to say, well, how would you evaluate this? And it's appropriate to do that before you start considering the system itself. Otherwise, your evaluation method may be skewed by the particular algorithm you're using. There's also, well, how are you going to formulate these queries? You know the kind of thing you want. Well, how do you communicate that to a system that will then return documents? And then there is also the question of how do you find? What is it that is going to give you the best matching document? And some things about ranking. Maybe you don't just want documents that are relevant. You want to know the ones that are most relevant. There is also then an implementation issue, which I'm not going to address at all, which is to how to represent the documents, how to store them in order to efficiently do whatever kind of retrieval algorithm you're going to follow. And that's kind of separate. You can have a retrieval algorithm, which is what's determining what best matching document is or what collection of documents. And then you've got separately, how would you implement that? How would you efficiently make that algorithm run in reasonable time on reasonable hardware for the data set you've got? So at the moment, I'm just going to be looking at really the evaluation, how would we measure the performance of an information retrieval system. Okay, and there's two big measures for this. We've got a system with lots of documents, we make some kind of query, it returns a bunch of documents and says these are the ones relevant to what you wanted to know. One instance of this is, of course, search, where you type in some keywords and you get back some web pages. But as I said, there are lots of other areas that are slightly more focused where this happens. And the two measures are precision and recall. Precision is is it the case that the documents you get back are in fact relevant to the query you made? So typically measured by what proportion of the documents returned by the system match the objectives of the search. So the crudest measure for this is you say, I've got a big collection of documents, and this sub-portion of them are relevant to my query, and these are not. You assume it's completely Boolean, and you want to know of an information retrieval system. So of the ones that came back, how many of them were good? How many of them were the ones I wanted? There's also recall, which is, of the documents that came back, how many of them were relevant? So these are independent measures. You might get lots and lots of documents back, but actually only a few of them are relevant. So even if it includes all the relevant ones, that's not so great because you then have to search through all the answers to see what comes back. So we've got this notion of relevant documents, and precision is about whether the query returns mostly relevant documents, and recall is about whether the query returns most of the relevant documents. And actually, characterizing that, getting numbers for this, depends on assessing positive and negative results. So the idea is that we have our data, our document set split into two. We have the relevant documents and the non-relevant documents. Now, of course, in one can have sophistications of this. You can talk about how relevant a document is and so forth. But the simplest measure is just say relevant, not relevant, and compare systems on that basis. And then we have whether they were retrieved or not. And so then these four categories arise. True positives, these are the ones where the documents are relevant and the query returned them. So that's all good. There are false positives. This is where you do a query, you get back a document, or some of the documents are not in fact relevant to the query at all. The system has misinterpreted your query, or for some reason it sort of document is about the subject you're interested in when it's not. So those are false positives. True negatives, those are also good, bottom right-hand corner. This is where a document was relevant to your query and it wasn't returned. False negatives, that's another kind of error, where the system returns a document, but you're not interested in it. It's not, in fact, relevant to the query at all, and you can immediately see this. So true positives and true negatives are good. False positives and false negatives are two kinds of error. And they're quite different sorts of error. One is returning a document that's not, in fact, relevant, and the other is missing a document that would be relevant. And there are lots of contexts in which, in statistics or surveying or assessing things, where these four categories arise, and you want to consider separately the two kinds of things that are good and the two kinds of things that are bad. And then we can use those, if you actually have these numbers, then you can compute values for precision and recall. Precision is measured by the number of true positives divided by the total number of positives. So of all the documents returned, what proportion were ones we were interested in? Recall is the true positives over the true positives and the false negatives. That's all the ones that are actually relevant. So the ones that were included and should have been, and the ones that were rejected but should have been included. And again, that's a fraction. So both precision and recall go between 1 and 0. Or might be expressed as percentages alternatively. And you can assess these four concrete systems on particular examples. And so if you wanted to assess competing information retrieval systems, then you might set up a particular query. You'd actually go through and find out the correct results, which documents are relevant to it, and keep those numbers, and then see what values how well the system did. So supposing you have a system with 130 documents, that should not be theory, that should be query, sorry, when 28 of them are relevant for some particular query. So this is similar to, remember when we had annotation, where you had maybe would annotate by hand some portion of a text in order to test out whether a particular automatic annotation method is correctly giving parts of speech and so on. So we have some document that's maybe smaller than the real big set we're looking at, but we've gone over it and we've established which ones are relevant to a particular query. So if we can tabulate this, we have, let's just check which way around. Right, so we have the idea of a document being relevant or not, and being returned by the query engine or not. Then we have totals. We have a total of 130 documents, of which 28 are relevant. Which means that 102 are not relevant to the query. So we have to find the documents that are relevant to a query inside this collection of 130. And we have a system one, which retrieves 25 documents. So retrieved 25 of the 130 documents and leaves 105 behind. And of those 25, 16 of them are relevant. So those are the true positives, the ones that were relevant to the query and got returned. That means that there were 9 of them were false positives. They were documents that the query returned, but in fact it shouldn't have done. They're not relevant to the topic we're interested in. There's also some false negatives, 12 of them, because System one only returned 16 relevant documents, but in fact there are 28 in there. So there were 12 documents that were relevant, but the system turned down. So these are both errors. And there's also a remaining 93 documents that aren't relevant and the system correctly didn't return them. So that's true positives, true negatives. This is the false positives and false negatives. So precision and recall depend on, so precision in this system, actually we can see this in the tables, precision is the true positives, this one, over the total number of documents returned, so 16 over 25, which is 65% or thereabouts. Recall is, well, of the documents there, how many were retrieved, and that's 16 over 28, which is just under 60%. So this system has both recall and precision of over 50%, but there's still a fair few documents that weren't returned, and some of the documents returned were not relevant. And then you can have another system that retrieves 15 documents, of which 12 are relevant, so it doesn't retrieve as many documents overall, and it doesn't retrieve as many of the relevant documents, but of the documents that come back, quite a lot of them are relevant. So that has a precision of 80%, but a recall of only 43. So its precision is higher. Of the documents that come back, they're more likely to be relevant, but its recall is lower. It doesn't actually recall as many of the things that you're interested in. So you can ask, well, which is the better system? And that's actually not immediately possible to say for this system, because one is better on precision, one is better on recall. So if you had two systems, P1 with precision, if you had P1 was less than P2, and R1 was less than R2, so a system where whose precision and recall was higher, that would be uniformly better or worse, depending on which one you're looking at, because it's uniform and it's better on all criteria, and that's good. You can here you can confidently say the second system is better than the first. But if, as we have in this situation, the second system is more precise but has less recall, then technically they're called incomparable. And there are lots of situations where this arises. You've got multiple criteria. If one thing is uniformly better than another on all the criteria, that's good. You can say that's the one to go for. But in many situations, you can have an ordering, but two particular examples might be incomparable. They're not. There's no sense in which one is better than the other on everything. And then you have to decide, well, of course, people are desperately unsatisfied with incomparable things because you want to find the best. And so you have various techniques for trying estimating. Well, in the situation where we've got some measures, but the two things are not directly comparable, how can we choose? What's the trade-off involved? And in general, for information retrieval, you want to have both high precision and high recall. If they have really low precision and really low recall, then it's just not particularly useful. And it's certainly not enough to look at just one of the figures. You can get a 100% recall system just by returning every document and say, well, the good stuff, it's in there somewhere. And so that will have 100% recall. All of the documents that were relevant were in the set you got back, but you'll never find them. Alternatively, if a system returns just one document, which is relevant, you have 100% precision. That's really great. But you've missed a whole bunch of documents that would be relevant. Up here, we have 28 documents that were relevant. If you had a system that returned just one correct document, then you'd have missed a whole lot. And that would look like it's got really high precision, but the recall would be low. And typically in such systems, you get a trade-off. You have an algorithm, and there are various parameters you might tweak to control the search or how it decides, the cutoff for when it decides to return a document or not. And there's a trade-off between precision and recall. You can change the parameters so you get higher precision by only letting a document in if the system is really confident that it's relevant. So that will give you higher precision, but it will give you lower recall, because some things that were relevant and the system maybe had identified them as potentially relevant but didn't have enough confidence to return them, you'd get more precision and lower recall. Or the other way around, you could have a parameter where you just said, if there's any chance the document is relevant, we'll throw it in. That would give you a higher recall but lower precision. And which is more important? Depends on the application of the system. It depends where you're using it. So in some situations, precision is everything. In some situations, recall is everything. So something like a patent search, you really, really want high recall. You want to know if you're searching for a previous patent on something that you've covered all the bases, or legal opinions as well. Whereas for, say, other applications, if you want to find a news article about something and you just want to learn about a topic, then it might be that precision is relevant. You want all articles that are about something, but you're not so fussed about getting absolutely everyone. If you want to do a search for current news on this, or if you want to do a search for information about the history of the extension of Europe, accession states, then you just want to find lots of news articles or lots of history pieces about this. It's not essential that you find everything everybody's ever written about the extension of the EU and the new accession states. You just want to find some sample of them. And so their precision might be important if you're doing a search on learning about a particular topic, but recall is maybe not so important. If you want to learn more about information retrieval and you do a Google search for it, then you want to get some documents about information retrieval. It's not essential that you get every document about it, but precision matters quite a lot. Networks, web search is a key area where you know about this precision recall trade-off, and you have experience of it, and people will rate their feeling about the success of a search or a search engine based on the trade-off between precision and recall. Typically, for a search engine, precision matters a lot. You really want the queries to be relevant. Recall doesn't matter so much unless you're looking at particular web pages. So precision matters because you want the pages that come up on the results that come up on the first page to be relevant. Recall only matters if you're looking for a specific page that you kind of remember and know, and you're disappointed if it doesn't come up with that. The basic example of that is when you're Googling yourself, is you don't care it brings up lots of relevant information. You want it to show your web page. Sample. I mentioned Google, but what search engine do people actually use? Hands up if you would think of a search engine that you'd use. Hands up who would use Google? Bing? Oh, you'd actually not use it. How would you unuse it? You'd avoid what web pages it returned. Any others? Cool, any meta searching? No? DuckDuckGo? No, absolutely nothing.
From Alpha.
Alpha, okay. Now that's interesting because that is definitely for a different task and so has a different aim. So it's not so good at producing web pages, but it is doing information retrieval. And it's related to answering questions that I'll come on to later. So yeah, it's Alpha, which works really well in some domains and in others less so. Okay, so you all use Google, so I'll use Google as the verb. So if you're searching for yourself, then obviously you want to find that page. You want to find you. You don't just want to find general information about people with this name. You want precision. Most of the time you just want, though you want recall, most of the time you just want precision. I'll check though. So, okay, hands up if you have ever Googled yourself to see if you're there. Right, those of you who haven't, lucky you, don't do it. You will live a life of peace and contentment. For those of you who Googled yourself, hands up if you were, top entry. Top five, first page, first 10 pages, first 100 pages. Sad thing is if you know that you're down at page 53. In that one, you want recall there. You really want it to come back. If you're using Google to search for a page you know is there, you really want it. I'd have to say that, even if you do it, you search, it gives you back as you as the top entry. You're really pleased with yourself. Trouble is that actually search engines really, really want to give you precision and recall. And so they'll use every bit of available information to give you the right results. And searches are, these days, pretty responsive to where you're coming from, what you've previously searched for. If Google can find out who you are, then they'll use that information to improve your searches. What people who Google from machines in that net block, you know, if you use one of the lab machines up here, then it will come as being from a computer science department, and that will affect the searches you get. If you're Googling yourself, Google really ought to return you as the first page because it should know who you are and what you're looking for. If you Google me now from inside this lecture theater, then it damn well should return. If it doesn't return me in the top three, then they're not doing their job. So you have to take this, real systems are much more sophisticated than the kind of thing I'm describing. You can't just do black and white measures of it, but this is a start for it. Okay. So we've got this trade-off between precision and recall, and I would say that, emphasize really, there is no right answer to this. These things are incomparable, and there are lots of situations where this is like, so there are ways to try and assess this and compare things that are incomparable, but then they're never going to be quite the same as having something uniformly better than something else. So one way to do this comparison is something called the F score. It's an evaluation measure that combines precision and recall. It uses the reciprocals of precision and recall. So remember, precision and recall go between 0 and 1, but that means that 1 over precision, or 1 over recall, will go from 1 and then up to infinity. That's unbounded. So whereas, and the idea is that you take a balanced average of precision and recall, but not precision and recall the cells, because those have a fairly small range, but they're reciprocal, which goes up to infinity. So you can get some very large 1 over precision or 1 over recall. It also stretches the areas of significance. So you have a weighting factor alpha, Greek letter, gratuitous Greek letter, and the F alpha score is 1 over alpha times 1 over p plus 1 minus alpha times 1 over r. So alpha goes between 0 and 1, depending on whether you're more interested in recall or precision. And you can tune it. You know, you can say that in a particular application, perhaps by testing out on some real users, you can have an information retrieval system where you can tweak its precision recall trade-off, and you try it with different samples of users, how they felt about a particular system. Did they feel it was giving good results or was capturing the things they asked for? You find out what their threshold is for being returned junk results among around the real ones. So you might tune it to see which weighting factor people are most happy with. High alpha means precision is most important. Low means that recall is more important. But if you don't have any such data, if you don't have information on which is more important, then you can just take 1/2, which gives what's called a harmonic mean of P and R. So a harmonic mean is a number between P and R. It's the product divided by the sum. I'll double that. And you can use it as a way to combine P and R measures. And this is general for any situation where you have these multiple measures and you don't know which one's important, you write something that will combine them all. And if you've only got one number, you can then compare things and you can say, this is better than that, and you can feel confident and the job's done. But it is worth being aware that it's slightly more subtle than that. There are complexities. It may be essential that you pick a single figure because you have to make a decision which system to go with or what trade-off to make between precision and recall. But bear in mind that it is complex, and ideally you'd like to improve both. There's no absolute reason why you can't have a system that has very high precision and very high recall. But typically systems involve a trade-off there. Okay, so here are the examples we had before, the two systems for recalling particular data. And if we take the balanced F score, then it turns out that the first system, which had both precision and recall were over 50%, but neither of them were that high, has a higher harmonic mean F score than the second system, which had really high precision, but comparatively low recall. So if you want a balance between precision and recall, you should go for the first system. If you're really interested in precision, you should go for the second one. Okay, so that's about the information retrieval problem and how you might measure whether you have a successful solution. Next time I'll talk about one algorithm for giving back retrieving documents or finding out how to decide whether a document is relevant to a query or not. But first I'll switch to, this is non-examinable now, a particular information retrieval question answering system. Who knows what or has heard of Watson in the last couple of months? Yeah? What is it? It's a computer that played Jeopardy. What's Jeopardy? Okay, who was aware of or knew the rules of the Jeopardy game show before Watson was entered on it? Okay, that's quite good. You're ahead of me. Now I have videos of this. You may have seen these before. And also I'm going to have to try and get this system to work on that. Watson is, it's an information retrieval system. It's actually something more specific than that. It's a question answering system. So this is from IBM. It's an extremely big computer that is, fits in a room, but doesn't have to be as big as this one. And it tackles the problem of question answering, or QA. And QA is a very specific. QA is a very specific problem like information retrieval or translation. It says, given a question, can you find an answer? And one of the ways you might do it is build a system that has lots and lots of documents it can consult and lots of information about those documents, and then it analyzes the question and looks at the documents and it finds an answer. And one of the insights that's come in the last few decades about this is, so initially people tried to build systems that really understood the question and really understood the problem domain, and so could really give you the answer. And that's useful, you can get a long way with that. But with large data sets becoming available, and the information that the machine might consult being much bigger than you can, by hand, annotate or give a semantic meaning to, there's a thrust of machines that will just use kind of bulk analysis of the data. In the same way we had statistical translation, its focus is on, in QA machines, is not does the machine understand the question, know the subject field, and understand the answer, but it's more, does it give the right answer? We go from question to answer, and we're not necessarily worried about whether the machine understands what's going on in the middle. Provided it can take the big mush of documents and your question and return an answer, then we leave to the philosophers the question whether the machine really understood the question or the answer. And this is harder than information retrieval. Information retrieval is about returning a relevant document which might contain the answer to your question. QA is about actually answering the question. So this is a bit like the distinction between Google and Wolfram Alpha, which is much more about answering a particular question. So is this the right one? The question answering problem is a standard field of artificial intelligence, and lots of progress has been made. And Watson is a QA machine. Oh, we're going to need to turn on some sound. Hold on. Watson is a QA machine built by IBM to show off their QA technology. And recently it entered a game show. Japanese game show in the US where, well, there aren't quite questions to be answered. There are answers to which you must find the question, but the answers are structured in such a way that the question is really, really fixed. And it's notable for being really popular and having gone on a long time. The questions are kind of slightly tricksy. There's a lot of wordplay in them. And also there's a lot of money involved. People win large amounts on this. And so this is kind of interesting. And it's seen as a hard problem for a computer to do. And IBM reckoned that their Watson machine could reasonably enter this, and it did. So last month there were a couple of games where Watson played two people. So there was a three-person round, which is the standard for Jeopardy. And the people that played were the guy who's won most money at Jeopardy. He's won about $7 million in previous rounds of Jeopardy. And the man who has won the most been on the show the most times, which is about 37. So these are both people who are very, 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 very good at question answering. They're certainly much, much better than you or I. I can't say that for certain of all of you, but they're better than the average. By a long, long way. They know a lot of stuff. So does Watson. It's a big machine. It's not online. It's got a big repository of information, but that's all statically stored. It doesn't surf the net at the top while it's running. But big means big. I mean, it has, for example, all of Wikipedia as one of its basic resources. Now, providing we can get some sound working, I shall attempt to show you two videos about this. The first one is an IBM kind of sales promotional video telling you how wonderful Watson is and what it's going to do. And the other is, I couldn't find footage of the actual game show it went on. It's a trial session between Watson and the two people it really did play in the game show. So we shall have to see if this works.
We're going to treat you to...
Okay, so that's the one where they're actually playing it, but this is the first one that's about it.
I say it's a sales video.
It's going to change how we interface with information.
People are going to ask, how did it do that? How did it accomplish this task, which before we thought only humans could ever hope to do?
David Hume held this view that sense and experience are the sole foundation of knowledge. Watson.
What is empiricism?
Watson is a question-answering system. A question can be posed in natural language, and having read a whole bunch of information, data, documents, come up with a very precise answer to that question.
It's an information-seeking tool that's capable of understanding your question to make sure that you get what you want, and then delivers that content through a naturally flowing dialogue. Do you have one of those? I don't have one of those, right?
Mm-hmm. It's a human standing there with their carbon and water versus the computer with all of its silicon and its main memory and its disk.
After Germany invaded the Netherlands, this queen, her family, and cabinet fled to London. Maria.
Who is Beatrix?
No. Watson?
Who is Wilhelmina?
That is correct.
Humans communicate very fluently in natural language. And that's where computers struggle dramatically. And that's where we want to make them better.
This U.S. president negotiated the Treaty of Portsmouth, ending the Russo-Japanese War. Watson.
Who is Theodore Roosevelt?
Good for $800.
And Jeopardy questions are tricky. They have puns in them. They have little jokes in them.
A famous red-coiffed clown, or just any incompetent fool. Watson.
Who is Bozo?
Nice. Good job, Watson.
I think we've gone from impressed to blown away.
This is really remarkable performance. And we know of no computer system that can come anywhere close to doing this question answering task.
Watson is the confirmed champion for this game.
But the reality is that being able to win a game at Jeopardy doesn't mean you've completely conquered the language understanding task. Far from it.
In REM's It's the End of the World as We Know It, two of the men with the initials LB. Watson?
What is I Feel Fine?
Ooh, no.
The worst thing is if Watson just crashes in the middle of a game. That's what you don't want. But then the second worst thing is if you have some horrible bug where Watson starts getting everything wrong.
What are trousers?
No.
What is harness racing?
No.
What is taxi to the dark side?
No.
What is artificial sweetener?
Come on now, no.
What is milk?
No. Very nicely done.
We both beat him.
Good for you.
Humans.
Woo. This is triage. There's a million things to consider here. This is just one.
We're gonna run out of time.
Our responsibility to the scientific community is to push this technology as hard as we possibly can, because when we get out there in public, what we're demonstrating is, what is the state of the art? What can we really do?
It's limitless, the number of things you could potentially apply this to.
Watson, you have control.
Okay, so now we're going to see it doing something. I should explain things it is and isn't doing. In the game there, you saw there are these guys pushing the buzzers. So there's a thing in the strategy where the guy reads the question, and you can't, and then a light comes on saying, now you can answer. And then you have to press the button, and the first person to press the button gets to answer it. And there's a trade-off about if you're confident, then you have to press the button really fast. And the guys who do it professionally, they're really, really fast in it. But Watson is faster on that. It can push a button faster than they can. However, that doesn't mean it doesn't get beaten at this, because there's also the time it takes to get the answer and the confidence in which you have it. So you'll see some instances where it's clear that Watson knows the answer, because there's some feedback on that, but it does not get to the buzzer first, possibly because its confidence in the answer came too late. There's also there's an auxiliary display that shows what answers Watson is considering, the top three answers it's considering to the question, its confidence in those answers, and also there's a bar that says how confident it has to be before it's prepared to answer. This is to do with game strategy about how much money you're going to lose, how confident you think how you're doing compared to the other people. If you're a long way ahead, you can afford to take a bigger risk, this kind of thing. So you'll see in the video there's some examples of where you can see the answer, you know Watson knows it, but it doesn't get to the buzzer in time, or you can see the answer it's really confident about, or an answer it's less confident about, or its second and third choice answers, which may be completely stupid, because they may have correspondingly low confidence. The other thing is that Watson is not doing speech analysis. The guy reads out the question, but in fact the contestants can all immediately see the full question on the video screen, and Watson doesn't even have to do character recognition on that, it's fed the text directly. So at the same time the humans see the thing on the screen, Watson gets the question in text. I think this is because, essentially, character recognition is a solved problem and they could do that, so that was not something I wanted to show off. It does do text-to-speech, though. It has to convert the text, its answer, into a spoken word. This is partly kind of for the look, because text-to-speech is managed, and you'll hear it sounds like a computer talking. This one was slightly challenging because it has an unusually awesome vocabulary, as do the guys doing the quiz, because its answers may come from an enormous range of things. This is not just generating text in order to have a call center. This is generating text about absolutely anything, generating speech from text about anything. So they did put some work into the pronunciation. Okay, oh, and the screen. So they had to come up with something that stands between the people playing it, and they have this computer screen with stuff going around on it. And actually, okay, so there's a real artist designed this. It's a globe with points running over it and other points chasing it, and the exact speed at which things move, where they move on the globe, the color of the points is affected by what how confident Watson is in its answer, how which stage it's in the game, whether it's betting a lot or a little, whether you're in a particular kind of round or another. So it's possible by looking at this display to get an idea for how confident or otherwise it is in the system. So there's things that you're seeing that are in there. They're not just, well, they are pretty pictures, but they're intended to be more. Okay, so here you get to see it play in a sample round with some real contestants, but not the real game show host, I'm afraid. He was too expensive at these kind of things. He only does the real thing.
We're going to treat you to a short round of Jeopardy. It's going to be hosted by a member of our Jeopardy Clue Crew. Please welcome Jimmy McGuire. Gentlemen.
Good morning, everybody. Thank you for being here. What do you say we play Jeopardy? Right, let's get right into the Jeopardy round. These categories: a man, a plane, a canal, Erie, chicks dig me, children's book titles, My Michelle, MC5, and finally, vocabulary. Ken, you're in the first position. Please make a selection.
I've never said this on TV. Chicks dig me for 200, please, Jimmy.
Kathleen Kenyon's excavation of this city mentioned in Joshua showed the walls had been repaired 17 times. Watson.
What is Jericho?
Correct.
400, same category.
This mystery author and her archaeologist hubby dug in hopes of finding the lost Syrian city of Urkesh. Watson.
Who is Agatha Christie?
Correct.
Same category, 600.
At the Olderby Gorge in 1959, she and hubby Lewis found a 1.75 million year old Australopithecus Boisei-eyed skull. Watson.
Who is Mary Leakey?
You're right.
800, same category.
Harriet Boyd Haas was the first woman to discover and excavate a Minoan settlement on this island. Watson.
What is Crete?
Yes.
Let's finish chicks dig me.
At Mount Carmel in Israel, Dorothy Garrod was the first to find this prehistoric human skeleton outside of Europe. Ken.
What is Neanderthal?
You're right.
Let's go to children's book titles for 200.
Marjorie Williams' story of a stuffed toy that comes to life, the blank rabbit. Brad.
What is Velveteen?
You're right.
MC5 for 200, please.
He's worth every penny as Alfred Pennyworth in The Dark Knight. Brad again.
Who is Michael Caine?
You're right.
MC5 for, let's jump down to 800, please.
Edgar Degas' style influenced that of this female American impressionist. Brad.
Who is Mary Cassatt?
Correct.
And MC5 for 1,000.
The film Gigi gave him his signature song, Thank Heaven for Little Girls. Watson.
Who is Maurice Chevalier?
Correct.
Same category, 400.
The parents of this 52nd governor of New York immigrated to the United States from Salerno, Italy. Watson.
Who is Mario Cuomo?
Correct.
Let's finish MC5.
This child star got his first on-screen kiss in My Girl. Ken?
Who's Macaulay Culkin?
Correct.
Children's book titles, 400.
By Judith Viorst, Alexander and the Terrible, Terrible, No Good, Blank, Blank Day. Ken?
What is Very Bad?
Correct.
Book title, 600.
By Dr. Seuss, The Blank Hats of Bartholomew Cubbins. Ken again?
What is 500?
You're right.
Book title's 800.
By Maurice Sendak, In the Blank Kitchen. Ken?
What is Night?
Correct.
Book title's 1,000.
A classic by Crockett Johnson, Harold and the Blank Crayon. Watson.
What is Purple?
Correct. Taking you to 4,400 and taking us to our first break. We hope you enjoyed it. I certainly did. We'll be right back after this.
Okay, so you can see it answers a lot of questions on a lot of things. Anybody know what the outcome of the real game was? Yeah, so that it ran over two episodes, and it was kind of slightly behind at the end of the first, and then it won at the end of the second. And the